Did you know that a young boy drowned the year before those two others were killed? The counselors weren't paying any attention. They were making love while that young boy drowned.
Hey guys, what's going on? You are listening to Beyond the Gauntlet, recorded semi-live at 14 Mill Street in Orangeville, Ontario. I'm one of your many hosts, patrons, and survivors, dare I say, for today's topic of horror movies. But I'm joined with the proprietor of Camp Crystal Lake.
Welcome to Camp Crystal Lake. I am Chris Pedro, owner and operator of the Gauntlet.
That's so Swedish.
And I'm also joined by the resident of 1428 Elm Street.
I am the Jamie that lurks in the night.
And I'm joined by the master of the Lament configuration puzzle box.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. I'm Jeff DeHang.
Beetle Jeff.
Now, if anybody got any of those references, you're awesome. So, anyway, guys, yes, we are back here for our... Typically what we're doing is we're on 3 weeks, we're off for one. But for the next month or so, you're going to have a new show every Monday. Because I'm going to schedule them for every Monday.
It'd be awesome. Aw, yeah. So you think your life was full of horror before.
Exactly. Your Monday
non-stop, baby.
So anyway, guys, we're going to be introducing a new segment to the show, and we're going to be running kind of a contest, but this one requires you to get your ass into the store. Jamie has found, through the mysteries of a closet somewhere, a bunch of old wizard magazines, an ancient tome, which kind of got people into comics long before we had the internet, really, and it sadly died a couple of years ago in its print form.
A sad, sad, depressing death.
We're going to have to do a memorial to Wizard Magazine at some point.
We could. I'm sure I'll talk about some of the great things and some of the most terrifying things that Wizard Magazine has done.
I can talk about Twisted Toy Fair Theater. Endlessly.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, God, which, yes. If anyone wants to know where Robot... Like, basically, Robot Chicken comes from Wizard Magazine.
Yes.
But to get to the point here, the key thing that I wanted to introduce, this we'll try it this week, and we'll see how it takes over, is the great thing about old wizards is they had what they called the CBIQ, the Comic Book Intelligence Quotient, which is a multiple choice quiz, and it was asking questions about all sorts of comic stuff. And the great thing is some of these are still legitimately good questions, and some of them you basically had to be a teenager in 1995 to get them. So it's sort of, it's taken a hop in the Wayback Machine. And
this is what I'm thinking, is that I started collecting in my 20s, so if these are all 90s wizards, I am going to be a spectacular failure.
It's a beautiful mix. But Chris, you want to explain what's our contest here? How are we gonna?
Well, here's how we're gonna do it. We're gonna play around with a few questions here at the table just for our own amusement. But then at the end of the segment, we're gonna post one open-ended question with a multiple choice answer, and if you come into the store and you give the correct answer to said question, I'll do a little something for you. Now, at this point, I can't say what it is, but you come up with the answer, and I will reward you at the time you come in. Ooh, mystery.
All right. So the great thing about the issue that I have today is it is the Halloween issue. So we have a spooky for 1995, years of the X-Files, though, still the good years, so it's still his legitimate pop culture scare cachet, based around comic books. So I'm going to ask you guys, and this is also a rare thing that we can do, we can make this an interactive podcast.
We could.
If you are playing along at home, you can pause and see if you can beat the geeks. Can you beat us?
A good show.
As it comes, great show. But to go to it. So are you gentlemen? Now, are you gentlemen ready?
Are we buzzing in, or what are we doing?
I think this is a first come first served deal.
All right.
And I'm going to avoid some of the more ridiculous questions. But
the answer is always RoboCop. Just so you know.
I do get competitive.
So Halloween's just about here, and this is the little text blurb I have. There's nothing scarier than this month's CBIQ. God, I miss old magazine typewriting. It's time for you to rank those useless hours of reading comics against the more frightening items found in the Green Goblin's purse. The higher you score, the more you'll wonder, which is scarier, a Green Goblin or a guy carrying a purse? Score 0 to 4 gets you a handkerchief covered with nose goblins. 5 to 14, that weird-looking massager. It's in quotations. 15 to 19, the photo of a clean-shaven Eddie Munster. Ooh.
Oof. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And 20 is a squeegee. So, gentlemen, here we go.
So you can gouge out your eyes on the Eddie Munster picture.
I have to ask you, are we doing the full quiz?
Or I'm going to truncate it because there are some key questions. Some ones that I do have to go just for nostalgia. But, okay, here we go. Which DC character was murdered in a swamp and later, after merging with rotted swamp material, became an eerie, superpowered humanoid?
Solomon Grundy.
Solomon Grundy. Didn't even have to. He said he wasn't even going to be good at these.
I was expecting you to, you know, finish the question, but I was also debating between Grundy or possibly Swamp Thing, because it is a very similar sounding origin, but Grundy was the first one.
Grundy was the one. Okay, what subversive ninja group just dug up the rotted, desiccated corpse of Spider-Man's foe, Dr. Octopus?
The Hand?
The Hand. Well done. You guys don't even have to read them. I do like the answers, though. The Dark Blade or the Shemar or the Hand or, of course, the colon. That would be D. Remember those scary DC storytellers? Anyone read Vertigo? Cain and Abel? Which house was Cain the caretaker of? Was it the House of Horrors, the House of Mystery, the House of Secrets, or the House of Buggin'?
I'll say Secrets. But it's just purely a guess.
Now, yeah, the House of Buggin', does anybody actually get that reference? Because I can tell you about John Leguizamo's one of his first TV shows.
Yes, that's what that was. I knew that sounded familiar. And that was good. It gave me time to reveal that it was the House of Secrets.
Booyah! I was going to go for House of Mystery.
All right, Jeff. Who is the disturbing creature that stole the pyrokinetic powers of Hellboy's buddy Liz Sherman? Was it the Mugwump, the Homunculus, the Somnambulist, or, of course, the Gluteus Maximus?
Was it the Homunculus?
It was the Homunculus. Hellboy named him Roger in the car.
I'm going to guess that probably none of these are D.
they tend to do this. And this is my favorite. I don't know how many people were alive to remember the Lady Death comics phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It was hitting its stride. This actually features the cover.
And a few years
Lady Death. We have to put a picture of this up because this is some classy 1995.
Was that
it is.
Repressed now, emotions?
Who
right?
Who drew that one, or who was the creator of Lady Death?
That was
it Billy Tucci? Or
It was what's his name? Stephen Hughes, I think was his name.
Stephen Hughes. Stephen Hughes.
He
actually brought Lady Death back for a very short-lived 19-issue series. About a year and a half, 2 years ago.
And they dressed her like a normal human, I seem to remember. Like, I saw pictures.
She wasn't quite as scantily clad.
The covers were still slutty, but the inside material was not as...
I think I saw a clip from that.
And just to bring it up, since we're on Lady Death, have you seen the animated movie?
I have
to. Really? I didn't even know one existed.
Yes, there is a Lady Death
My wife told me about that. I haven't watched it. You can find it on YouTube, I think.
I found it in a $5 bargain bin at Walmart and watched it.
That's cool.
And it was $5.
Get out of here.
It was worth exactly that. All right, here we go. What happened when Purgatory, this is one of Lady Death's friends, Purgatory, of course, spelled P-U-R-G-A-T-O-R-I,
right?
Because it's not clever unless it sounds like a stripper name.
Right. Exactly.
What happened when Purgatory, after 2 years of searching, finally found her nemesis, Dracula? Okay, so you got to put yourselves in a 90s comic mindset. Which one of these sounds more likely for a rather exploitative 90s comic? Purgatory became one of his brides, A. Dracula defeated Purgatory and tore off her wings to remind her that he was his superior. She killed him by draining his blood, thus leaving him too weak to find shelter when the sun rose. Or D, they decided to team up to fight evil Ernie, who was killing his way through Europe.
I'm going to say A.
I'm going to say D, actually.
D sounds is it, something 90s, but so does B.
Is it blatant crossover bait? It is actually, she became one of his brides.
Really?
Booyah.
Wow. That is terrible, that not, terrible that comics, the, terrible 90s
you know
comics
what?
At
it
their
was,
best.
It was 90s mindset. My thoughts went to sex, and that was the closest one to it.
We're like 90s sex, which is like Cinemax without the nudity.
Well, again, look at that Cinemax, cover. With
yeah, exactly. Death, so. Okay, I've got three more. Okay, what other gigantic freak monster did Fing Fang Foom team up with to defeat the alien invasion force of the Gargoyles of Stonis 5? And yes, that is a real story. Was it Ymir the Frost Giant, It the Living Colossus, Godzilla in his Marvel series, or Ultimo the really big creature guy?
Ultimo, Godzilla. The really big creature guy.
I really want it to be Ultimo. I'm pretty it's Godzilla.
I'm a kaiju
we are looking
fan
at It. The Living Colossus.
I thought it was that, but I didn't want to say it.
Okay, which supernatural spirit only appears one night a year and perpetually crushes the dreams of a small boy?
Is it Sleepwalker?
The editors of DC?
A, the Spectre. I'm not that small. The Great Pumpkin, Etrigan, or Digger?
Oh, that's the Great
it's
Pumpkin.
The great it's pumpkin. The Great Pumpkin. It's the Great Pumpkin.
I didn't know if we were going there.
This one's one of my favorites. How did J. Jonah Jameson's son, John, become the hairy-palmed man-wolf? Was it A, he was bitten by a werewolf while on a mission for the CIA in Eastern Europe? B, he was cursed by an evil communist Eastern European gypsy while traveling through Hungary. That is a lot of adjectives. C, a stone he found while on the moon grafted itself to his body, causing him to turn into the man-wolf on the night of a full moon. Or D, while John was attending a science demonstration, a radioactive wolf bit him, thus giving him the proportionate strength of a wolf.
Okay, this is the 90s. I'm going to have to go with the moonstone.
It was totally the moonstone. He had a mystic moon rock in his chest.
Yeah, that was the moonstone.
And I believe he married She-Hulk at some point as well. No, yes.
I think they were engaged. I don't think they actually got married because...
No, the wedding was broken up by something. I can't remember what it was. Yeah, what's the question for our fans at home?
Question for our fans at home was, what was the creature created by Dr. Victor Frankenstein known as in the DC universe? Was it A, the spawn of Frankenstein, B, Adam, C, the Patchwork Man, or D, Marilyn Manson?
The Patchwork Man?
We're not answering
this. I can't tell you. That's your bet. I actually do not know. I am inclined to not say Marilyn Manson.
I was going to say that. Well, there goes my answer.
Yeah.
It was Glenn Danzig.
That is the one for the viewers, or the listeners, I should say. There is no viewing.
Unless you're looking at the picture of
Lady Death we put up with this episode, then maybe you're a viewer. But
as long as you're only a viewer and not an active participant,
right?
If you know what I'm saying,
participate. Come in with the right answer, which I do know the right answer to this question.
Oh, nice.
Yes, I do.
Ooh, look at this guy.
Amazing, isn't it? And if you post me the answer, I will give you a little something on your next purchase at the store.
So let's start today's topic. We are looking at horror movies, comics, all sorts of things, because it's that time of year. And if you've been listening to the show over the last couple of days, last couple of days, you know you're going to be burned out by this point, because I've got a commentary for Dracula coming up tomorrow and some other great stuff. So there's a lot of stuff in horror, a lot of stuff in horror and comics that have happened for a long time. What was everybody's first horror comic?
Okay, Jeff, what do you got? What was yours?
That's tough, because I mean, I haven't read a lot of them, but I've gotten a few of the DC. They were doing like holiday specials all the time. Like they do a Christmas one with a whole bunch of short stories in it, and they've had a couple of Halloween ones, and I've actually read those.
Valentine's Day one too.
And they can be kind of interesting. It's always nice to get just a collection of short stories, because then you know you're not too burned out by anything too heavy. And it's usually a bigger sized issue, like 80 pages maybe. So those are ones that I've read a fair bit. Marvel Zombies, I was really into them for the first few runs of that. So yeah.
Who was the writer on that? Was that Bendis or was that...
No, the first couple was actually Kirkman.
Yes, that's how I knew. He's the one that started it.
That's why the first couple were really good, and then they kind of started to taper off a little bit.
Kirkman, of course, he of the Walking Dead fame.
Yes.
Fame of being Kirkman.
What about you, Jamie? You read any horror comics? What do you enjoy?
For me, I would say that I haven't read a lot of horror comics. I'm a fan of horror, but at the same time, like, I can't stand typical monster stuff. Like I'm not a firm believer in the supernatural. Like if you watch like a ghost story, it doesn't really scare me. The stuff that really scares me and the stuff that I really enjoy, and the first comic that I would qualify as a horror comic that got me in was Walking Dead. I had the compendium of the first like 9 or 10 volumes in that giant 1,000-page beast.
Yes,
and
the
phone book. And I was on a flight from Tokyo to Toronto, and I had it, and I'm like, well, great, I have something to read now. But I got really invested in that, to the point where I was like, just not, like, the world was zoned out. My wife was like, you were sitting there for 3 hours occasionally just gasping.
that kind of is The Walking Dead, right? Sitting there for 3 hours just kind of gasping.
Well, either you are or the zombies are. I have to say, again, we'll probably get to this later, but like Walking Dead 100 probably has one of the most terrifying moments, I think, ever in comics, which is all about the people. And I don't want to spoil it in any way, but like, it's the first time that I ever read a comic and it like basically shook me because of what happened in issue 100, because it was just really great. I don't want to say like great violence, but it was visceral, and it had this really great gut reaction to it. So, Chris, how about you?
Very first horror comic I ever read was kind of a crossover with superheroes. Action Comics Annual number 2, Batman and Superman go up against a coven of vampires. And it was actually kind of
like
scary
fun.
Because Batman actually becomes a vampire temporarily. And it was one of those Elseworld things.
Okay.
Where Superman has to kill Batman with a stake. And it was just like the most, when I was like a 8-year-old or 9-year-old kid at the time, it was just the coolest thing I had ever seen. Superman just staked Batman the vampire.
That is the situation that needs like a one-liner just before.
Oh, I believe there was a one-liner, but I can't remember.
It's got to be
it
something like...
He buried him in a swamp after. I remember that.
And then he became Solomon Grundy.
Yeah, then he...
After that, I mean, I've always been a fan of horror ever since my uncle sat me down in front of Alien when I was like 6 years old.
Oh.
Fabulous.
You know, ever since then, I've been an avid fan of horror of all types. I think recently I've enjoyed Stitch, which was really good by Guinness. So,
Garth Ennis? Yeah.
Garth Ennis. And that one, it had just enough supernatural to not be on this side of cheesy, but enough horror to make it shock value.
Is that different from Crossed, or is that...
Yeah, Crossed is a book that's about a virus that hits humanity, and... basically, it causes the human race to lose all inhibition, and they basically become a bunch of savages.
Yeah, and the whole shtick behind that is like it's like zombies who are aware of how horrible they are.
And the whole cross thing is, if you are one of these things, you have this rash across your face that's like a cross that goes from your forehead to your chin, and then across your eyes.
And it's an excuse for Garth Ennis basically to indulge in any sort of visceral gore.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. The whole concept of the book is just for him to put as much blatant bloodshed and gore into a comic as he possibly can for shock value. Now, the first Crossed was actually well done, but some of the stuff since then has been jumping at the bit a little, and it's kind of like the Saw movies.
Yeah,
and the first one was actually intelligent, and then they just started going downhill from there.
The first Saw movie did have Cary Elwes doing some of the like best scenery chewing of his career.
Oh, absolutely. However, the
Stitched is different.
Stitched is actually, I don't know if there's any truth behind it or anything like that. If the fairy tale that he's based it off of has any sort of real world thing, but apparently it's about a team of Marines that are in Afghanistan and they come across a supernatural entity in Afghanistan that apparently the Afghanis believe in, which is kind of like a cross between a zombie and a voodoo zombie where it's like a master controlling it.
Right, right.
And they're called Stitched because every orifice on their body is stitch closed. And these things just tear through this like team of Marines like they're made of peanut butter. So, and there's been several since, and they each have interesting spins, but it's always the same concept as some guys controlling these weird zombie creature things.
Nice,
but,
yeah.
But it's well written and whatnot. So yeah, that's my currently. I'm a fan of the Crossed and the Stitch stuff lately, just because it's the horror that I like.
Yeah, for sure.
What about you, Mike?
What do you got for us?
Well, I guess my first experience with horror type-ish, and I guess it's not a horror comic per se, but he exists in a horrible world, was Spawn.
Yep.
I would definitely qualify that, sure.
It's definitely horror.
The movie was a horror.
Yeah.
I still have a great love for that film.
Come back home, Michael Jai White.
John Leguizamo's finest role, The Violator.
The first issue I remember picking up was the one where he meets Angela. I think that was number 9.
It was 9, yeah.
No
copyright
Marvel
Comics in my book.
And then I started getting into, there was a series, like I stopped reading Spawn after like issue 70-something. And then I found out they were doing a new Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street comics. In fact, I actually have them for sale here at the store, actually.
If they're still here.
If they're still here.
I'm not sure if I've sold them yet or not. Yeah. I can't remember.
But I got back into it, and I'm like, oh my God, this is, it's a continuation. And the stories got really cool. And then they started doing other crossovers. And the one I really started following was, it was Ash from Evil Dead versus Freddy and Jason. And I think it was called The Nightmare Warriors.
Yes.
That sounds like the worst 80s like hair metal band ever.
No, this thing just
are the Nightmare Warriors.
Oh, dude, it was
this
so
thing
cool.
Was 80s horror. It literally was.
Okay, but so explain to me my, again, I come from, I appreciate the Nightmare series and Friday the 13th as like the cheese. The cheese factor is more what I get out of it. I don't necessarily consider them scary.
Only the first ones in each series I would consider scary.
So, but what's the draw for, like, what do they do when they hang out? That's, I guess that's my question. How do Freddy and Jason exist in the same?
Basically, what is their like downtime like?
Well, I mean, like in the series of the book, like what happens in 28
in,
pages?
In those ones, the basic storyline is Freddy and Jason are in hell. And I think Jason is immortal. He can't die anyway. So it kind of steals part of the plot from Freddy and Jason.
I was going to say, does it continue on sort of
something similar?
Ash gets his hands on the Necronomicon and yeah. brings them out of hell. And then Freddy and Jason and Ash all throw down.
Hold on, that leap. Why does Ash bring them out of hell?
Well, because he's always bumbling around with the Necronomicon, doing things he shouldn't be doing. You know,
crazy Ash.
That crazy Ash.
But yeah, and it's cool because it combines all the survivors from every movie, and they'll kill off certain ones. They turn ones. They actually make Freddy's daughter from Number 6, Maggie, fucking evil. Like, literally, she stabs the entire Nightmare group in the back. She's like, oh yeah, I'm totally with my dad. Now you're all going to die. And it's friggin' intense, man. And it's so cool because it's like every 80s fan conversation we've all had, like who would win in a fight sort of thing. And it got me back in the horror comics. I love franchise stuff like this. Like, as we talked on this show previously, if it's a licensed property, I'm probably into it.
So let's bring something up, guys. I mean, we all love a good scare. We love...
Yeah.
We love... horror genres in general as a culture.
Yep.
But what is it that makes something a good horror story? Like what is it that you each think makes a good horror story?
It's totally, I think it's individual.
Well, it's a subjective thing.
That's why I said, what we, for you, and I was going to go around the table with this.
Oh, so, well, like what, sorry.
I was going to say, like, you know, what to you guys is something that, you feel that a horror story has to have to be in its creepiest nature. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, for me, it's not even so much the big, like, scares and stuff. Like, I learned when I was pretty young that as far as, like, you know, those jumping moments in movies would be nothing without the score.
Yeah.
It's more, you know...
It's all sound design.
It's more the music hitting at that certain point. So it's not so much what's going on screen. For me... It's not even, you know, big things or like, you know, zombie apocalypse or big giant monster or whatever. Although I'm a huge fan of monster movies. Those are my favorite kind of horror. Like I'm 7 years old and I'm like watching Jaws and watching the shark eat people and everything, you know. But I find the scariest things are the things that are almost the simplest. A perfect example is one that actually didn't involve any kind of supernatural. Is The Strangers.
Yes, that was a great movie.
Fantastic.
You know, and I mean, as far as actually being scary, I mean, what's more terrifying than that scenario?
Yeah. I actually just watched it maybe a month ago for the first time, and I really, it's probably one of the first American horror movies I've enjoyed in a long time.
I feel like that's almost what they need to do to really kind of be a true horror movie.
Yeah,
per se,
and the plot of what's the plot of The Strangers?
It's just I believe it's a newly married couple, and
or I think that he just proposed or something.
Or he might
but,
just proposed, like
oh yeah, because the first like 20 minutes is just them arguing.
Yeah,
which is so great.
So and it's
marital
just,
discord.
These people with masks are in the house. They wind up torturing and leaving them for dead. I don't believe you ever actually see their faces or anything. Like, they got masked the whole time. And I think they take them off at the end, but you don't actually
see
their faces.
Yeah, you don't actually see their faces.
And they leave, and that's it. I believe it's Scott Speedman and Liv Tyler are the couple in it.
Yep.
Isn't that supposed to be loosely based or somewhat based on Charles Manson, what he did to a family with a group of friends?
Oh,
I heard that somewhere.
Maybe.
Possibly.
It's the same...
I think it's loosely based on what Manson actually did to one family and actually kind of messed with them.
But I think that's kind of what true horror is now, is like things that aren't out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
You know, Strangers, Seven, Silence of the Lambs, you know, all those things involved regular people who were just crazy messed up in the head. What about you?
I was just thinking about the actual logistics of Buffalo Bill's human skin suit, and I'm like, well, man, he's almost there. He's got some moisturizer. But actually, Jeff,
the skin or it gets the hose again.
Oh, Jamie Gum, come back home. Why do I know all these characters? I totally agree with you, Jeff. I think that the key thing, more like legitimately chilling and scary. For me, is all about human tragedy. It's all about actual people, actual things that aren't beyond the realm of impossibility. Like, I stopped being scared of aliens and monsters, you know, when I was like 15, 16. And you know, I realized that, you know, that's probably not going to happen. But this idea of The Strangers is a really great example. A really, really great comic. There's an indie comic guy called Derf Backderf, and he wrote... he was actually friends. He knew in high school, he knew Jeffrey Dahmer. And he wrote a comic about his experiences, just how their worlds intersected. And not mm-hmm. for any... And it's a really great comic because it really analyzes the stuff that he saw and where it fits sort of into the mythos. And it really comes off as it could be a cash grab. It could be just him saying, hey, holy crap, I knew this guy. Ask me questions about it. But it really comes off as a really sort of creepy look at this person and how he became sort of the monster.
Almost like a hindsight 2020 thing where it's like, oh, so him becoming that kind of explains all these behaviors that he had back in the last
scene is him getting a call from one of his friends once Dahmer was arrested. But after all his crimes were found out, he gets a call and sort of you see all the pieces coming together. And it's a really, really, really great comic.
Interesting.
And in the same way, like The Walking Dead is a great comic because it's a scary comic because it's about human tragedy. All the shock and gasp moments aren't from zombies. They aren't from monsters. They're from how the people are screwing each other over.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is legitimately scary. Like, mm-hmm. these things that are actually, you know, could happen. People, there, you know, if there's a war for resources, if there's, you know, a pathogen we can't identify. So I think, you know, that idea of human tragedy, but also this fear of the legitimate unknown, like not really knowing what would happen if people were in that situation, I think is another
big
thing.
Oh, we'd all become a bunch of savages.
So that's...
Well, because when the bottom line comes down to it, it's about survival, right? Mm-hmm. And survival of the fittest, unfortunately, is hardwired into us.
Well, and the razor's edge that humanity sort of treads on every day, basically, you know, being
able
to...
our friendly neighborhood greetings and everything that we do in a daily life, I mean, that's all basically... We're all animals when it all basically comes down to it. You know, we've just learned to throw this gloss coating over everything, so we're not... Because we can go to a supermarket and find food.
We're getting really nihilistic.
No, but it's true, though.
No, and that's what...
You're thrown into a survival situation, and you'll find the things that you will do to survive suddenly overpass... Things like common sense. Like, should I or shouldn't I? And basically, your fight or flight response just takes over.
Yeah, for sure. And that's again, what I think also good horror does is, again, you know, coming from an English teacher perspective, is it makes you think about how the nature of humanity, where we are, why we do what we do, why the things scare us that scare us. And I think that all sort of boils together to make a really good piece of horror.
Absolutely.
Chris, how about you?
And You know what? I agree with both you and Jeff on what makes that. But you know what? I also have that soft spot in my heart for a good paranormal kind of supernatural kind of thriller.
Yeah.
And I think part of me, it's just like there's a piece of me that is like wants the unknown.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think that's why supernatural thrillers, not so much as the monster thing. The monster thing is all just derived from a serial killer that, you know, they put a scarier form on. But when it all boils down to it, though, it's like the movies like the exorcism movies or the you know what, the ones that actually scare me even more so are the ones with the slight religious undertones to them, because you know we don't know.
yeah, and
right. We don't know, like, and we're not gonna know until we all push up daisies,
right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. So, anything that has that kind of slight connotation to it, and I'm not talking about the jump out and scare you movies, like you said, because most of that's the music score that leads up to it that puts you in the right mindset to accept the oh, it's gonna jump out here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In fact, exactly. Most movies now I go to, it's just like, and it's going to jump out here.
There it goes.
And there it is, right? And they don't even scare me anymore. But the ones that touch on like mental thing. One of my favorites is In the Mouth of Madness.
Yes, that is a great underrated movie.
Sam Neill, so John Carpenter did it.
Yep.
In the Mouth of Madness, and it was basically a guy's trip of going insane.
Yeah, it's so.
Jacob's Ladder is another.
That was
awesome.
I was just going to mention.
Movie.
Yes,
Jacob's Ladder. I love that as a horror movie because it was basically the whole setup for the movie is a guy's life as he's in his last moments of life.
Yeah,
but all the crazy stuff that happens in his flashbacks,
which I think is another key thing, is that idea of an unreliable narrator.
Yeah,
is a key element of horror, not knowing what this person's talking about.
Now, don't get me wrong. I take great pleasure in watching a Friday the 13th or a Nightmare on Elm Street just because they're cheese fun, right? They're, you know, who doesn't like to see the rampaging maniac go and kill somebody creatively with a weed whacker or something? But the ones that really, really scare me are the ones that have that little bit of underlying truth or a little underlying this could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or the ones that are even the paranormal ones that are based on a true story. Now, because the truth behind a true story with something paranormal is all in the eyes of the beholder.
And
and if somebody believes that crap happened to them, then it literally did scare them.
Yeah, I watched...
Whether that's legitimate or not.
I watched The Conjuring a while back.
It's supposed to be
Which is really impressive.
Came out on DVD this week, actually. Yeah, I think they rushed it to get it out before Halloween.
For a movie that is based... And, I mean, it actually made me want to go and learn more about these people. And the investment... that these people actually had in the research and their belief in it was really, it added to that sort of, it's not just another scary movie. There's element, and you could tell the parts that were obviously, you know, embellished a little, but it was a really interesting thing to actually see.
Like another one of the movies that I love, and it's because it's got a slight undertone to it, is The Mothman Prophecies. Okay. Because this was really based on an event that happened. And everybody kind of tied it to a supernatural entity, the Mothman.
Dick Tex. Is that from that one?
Yeah, exactly.
It's been a while since I saw that movie.
That movie, because of the fact that it was based on an event that really happened with the collapsing of this bridge, but they tied the supernatural thing around it.
Right.
Because of that, it made you step back and go, well, what if? You know, sort of thing. And those ones that make you walk away from it going, well, what if? Are, to me, the ones that are the best horror movies, because then they've managed to make you believe in the reason you were scared.
Yeah. And there's,
I was just going to say, and I mean, studios even have their little tricks to kind of make it seem more realistic. Perfect example is the found footage film. How many paranormal activities are we up to now?
Too many.
It all started with the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, but so. what is the next one? It's like Paranormal Activity, Dead Man Walking, or they've given up on numbers and it actually has a subtitle now.
I just watched the trailer for that last night. Yeah, the Chosen Ones.
The Marked Ones.
The Marked Ones.
Yeah.
The guys we could hire for less than minimum wage.
Yes.
It's like
the paranormal happens in the ghetto.
Those guys are on wires.
That was like, wasn't that Leprechaun 3?
Leprechaun in the Hood?
Leprechaun in the Hood.
Yeah.
Featuring Warwick Davis. Yeah, that's
and then
right.
Back to the that's Hood.
Back to, oh yeah, he returns. Yes, he also was in space.
Yeah, but so yeah, the space one's the
okay,
one that
so,
I remember
so
most.
I just to take a little detour, which was the best, worst franchise like sequel? We have Jason X, which had Jason in space.
Which was awesome.
Which was like, and then how does he get turned into Cyborg Jason?
Oh, the robot computer. Lexa Doig's character, I think it is. The one from, whatever.
I love how much nerds know.
Blows
it's beautiful.
The crap out of him with dual machine guns. He gets knocked into this nanomachine thing.
Oh,
but the
nanites.
Bullets hit the machine. They assume Jason's dead. But it screws up the machine, so it rebuilds Jason into this Uber Jason.
It makes him stronger, faster.
Oh, that redesigned mask.
So there's Jason. There's Jason well, 10. There's also Leprechaun in the Hood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which ends. I didn't realize, but that Warwick Davis scene is the end of the film. He ends rapping in a bar.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. If you look up, it's on YouTube, the end of Leprechaun 3, it's Warwick Davis in full Leprechaun outfit, like doing a rap. And it's just beautiful in how terrible it is.
Yes. Yeah,
and then
the hate watching the it. It's
my
finest.
Personal favorite is Jaws 4 The Revenge.
Oh, yes.
Which is unequivocally Michael Caine's lowest point
that
as
like
an
Superman
actor.
And it could be tied into the Batman universe, though, because this could be his life before Bruce Wayne.
And Jaws was the guy that had the jewel thief from the forest.
See, there you go.
Well, that's like if you've ever seen really the Piranha 3D movie,
yes.
But Richard Dreyfuss's character is actually his character from Jaws, where he's trying to get away from the ocean and gets eaten by piranha in a lake.
There's a really great stand-up bit by the late Richard Jenny where he talks about Jaws 4 as one of these movies that you watch at like 3 a.m. And the two greatest things about Jaws 4, one is the fact that apparently Jaws has the scent of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Because in between 3 and 4, he killed off like 3 of the sons.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey.
And then,
this was the one because of when it came out. This was actually the first Jaws that I saw, and then I was really young.
Yeah,
and
I had to
go back and watch the rest. And I mean, I loved it. And of course, now I look back at it, and it's a Jaws movie. I'll still love it, but I'll love it for the sake of oh my god! Like there's no actual real shark footage in Jaws: The Revenge. The entire thing is Bruce, and Bruce was the nickname they dubbed the mechanical shark on set. There's a scene where they're diving down in the water and they get to the bottom, and of course, you know, it's the ocean, but it's movie ocean, so right. It's crystal clear.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's, I'm just going to keep referring to him as Bruce.
You have to at this
there's
point.
Bruce motionless on the bottom. Okay. Little factoid here. Sharks have to keep moving in order to survive. They can't stop.
See, that's that amount of detail. For me, my favorite part was the fact that the main character, what's the actress's name?
Oh,
I
want to
say
so
like
long.
Shelley Duvall, but I don't think that's right.
No,
she goes from a landlocked state. She's in like Montana or something. Mm-hmm. And she goes from a landlocked state to get away from these memories of Jaws. No, she's up in like Maine or something. And then
yeah,
she goes to Florida.
Son gets eaten
yeah.
At the beginning
she goes
of the movie.
To Florida and Jaws is already there. Jaws waiting has swam.
Psychic from, shark.
He is faster than a jet, A. He knows where she's going, B. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, okay, fine. You know what? This is what
that's,
you're doing
that's
with this.
Amazing.
And this is not even the best scene where Michael Caine falls in the ocean and emerges completely dry.
Oh, yes.
Because you know the conversation went like this. Someone's like, look, Michael, you got to get in the ocean. I'm not getting in the ocean. No, you have to do. I'm not doing it. Fine. Just roll the camera. Let's get this over with. Where's Bruce?
Yeah.
So, you know, but yeah, thank you. Thank you for my diversion.
No problem.
Not a problem. Anytime you want to talk about Jaws, I'm game.
I think my favorite sequel to like in the mass sequel market of horror movies.
Troll 2?
No, well, Troll 2 is fantastic in its own right, but no, I was a huge fan of Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
Oh,
it wasn't that bad.
Was that the actually one? This is the one where
it's supposed
Freddy
to take place
Krueger
in real life
comes
kind of
after Wes Craven and the producers of the Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay, yeah,
movies.
Yeah, that's that one.
And it actually Freddy Krueger in it looked more menacing than he'd ever did in the actual movies. He had like the trench coat to go with his costume too, and he seemed a little bit more cutthroat and serious, and not the goofy bastard he is in like Nightmare on Elm Street 2 through 7.
And actually, it's interesting because that there's Troll 2, which is sort of the legendary worst movie of all time, and has spawned an amazing documentary called The Best Worst Movie, which if you haven't seen, you need to check out. It is amazing. They reconnect.
Have you ever seen The Stuff?
Oh, that movie is wicked. I love The Stuff.
The Stuff might be in contention there for the worst movie.
There's another Canadian one called Things.
Yeah, oh
which is legendary for how terrible it is. But there's an interesting crossover because I think a lot of people who really like cheesy films, and this is I'm excited to tie this back to comics too, is that if you look at movies like Slither, if you look at Super, which is
James Gunn,
Who's the guy who's directing the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, which I'm super stoked for.
Super was a fantastic movie in its own right, too.
Yeah, the intro to Super alone is worth any price you pay to see it. The intro is just gorgeous.
I just like the shock value of some of the things that happen in that movie.
And that's the moments in that, he embraces the cheese so much. He's also got a really interesting YouTube series called Clean Porn, where he does...
Oh, is this the PG porn?
Yeah, the PG porn.
Oh, the PG God, porn. The Nathan Fillion one is funny.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And he's got the one, Wash from Fireflies in one, too.
Oh, God, I did not expect the ending of that one.
Yeah, which has got such a great ending.
Alan Tudyk.
Yes, Alan Tudyk. But that there's that next step of being so... of merging that sort of self-awareness. And I think this sort of ties back to what you guys were saying about horror being something that is atmospheric and unknown. The more I think we're getting to that stage where so much is known, you know, we know more about the human genome, we know more about space, we know more about, you know, if you think about like the idea of lost continents can't really exist anymore. Google Earth has us covered.
Yep.
You know, you pretty much know where everything is. But we're getting to that point where a lot of the horror now is all meta. You know, where you're thinking about like the new Nightmare, right? Where he's coming back to kill Wes Craven. And a lot of the horror are people who are aware of that with those tropes, but like building off of it. Mm-hmm. The villain, another actor I can't remember, the guy in Slither, who was also the dad in Mallrats.
Michael Rooker?
Yes.
Yeah. Michael Rooker
is
yeah.
so good. And also he's in and yeah. And he's also in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes, he
yeah,
is.
It's going to be so like that sort of character is just so great. And that movie has some of the best like Slither has some of the best scary gore, cheesy, like it mixes scary and cheesy gore all together into one big package and it's just awesome.
Oh, cheesy gore has always been a staple of horror movies though. What about you, Mike? We haven't really got to you. What makes a good horror movie to you?
I think when you can put yourself in the person's shoes, or it makes you question philosophy.
Nice.
And I was actually watching the 1931 Frankenstein last night, last night as of this recording, last week as of when this was posted. And I talked during the DVD commentary, which comes out later on this week, about the horror of what Frankenstein represents. Because I don't consider Henry Frankenstein from the movie to be a bad guy. Misguided. Because he thinks his discovery will change the world. But imagine being Frankenstein, the monster. You're stitched together. The last thing you remember is the lights are out. You're dead. What happens to you when you wake up, realizing you've come back from the dead? Try and tell me that is not utterly frigging terrifying when you really put yourself in those things. Because
my problem is I start thinking about Frank and Venture from the Venture Brothers.
Why is my left arm smaller than my right arm?
Well, let's not forget the
look
the
at
main...
a tattoo. Who's Doris?
Yeah, exactly.
The main key with the Frankenstein story, though, is that it was an abnormal brain. So it was, I mean, abnormal, I guess, for the term that they would use at the time. But that very
insane
well
means or criminal
it was
insane.
Somebody who was
they
insane
didn't,
or criminal.
They didn't
insane,
have the
exactly.
word fanboy back then. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, to me,
if it was a fanboy, wake up and be like, "All right, yeah,
I mint again."
But yeah, to me, it's always that fear of the unknown. Like, there's a great Lovecraft quote about different types of fear, and the greatest and oldest type of fear is the one of the unknown, because we don't know. Mm-hmm. There's actually a great quote, it paraphrases it similarly, in the GURPS Cthulhu punk book, which came out in the late 90s, and it says, gross is something hitting you in the face, like a blood or gore or something. Terror is seeing a spider the size of a dog. Absolute terror is having everything in your entire life replaced by an exact duplicate.
Nice.
And that's the type of, that's what makes horror to me, when you can do that. Very few movies have effectively done this, in my opinion. Like Jeff was saying, sound plays such an important role, because if you watch a horror movie on mute, it's really funny.
You almost picture the Benny Hill theme in the background.
Yeah. And we were watching The Conjuring last night, once again, last week, and that's what we're doing for our Halloween commentary. Me and my friend Dave were talking about it, and just the effective use of music and, you know, perspective on a camera. That's another thing, too. With horror movies, if you put the camera, if it's a person, if it's handheld, you'll see a slight bob to it. And it's almost like you're there with them. In The Conjuring, they use it so effectively.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
with Ed and Lorraine Warren. Like, you're feeling like you're sitting over their shoulders as they listen back to the EVPs and all that stuff. And even at the end of the movie, when the all hell breaks loose, you literally feel like you're in that moment. Like, stuff could be flying at you.
Another movie that I watched recently that kind of put me in that same mindset was The Fourth Kind.
With the chick from Resident Evil?
I watched that, yes, with doing the weirdest introduction. The Fourth Kind is a really cool concept. There's a lot of really cool moments, but there's also a couple moments where you're like, because I think the director won a short move, won an Oscar, was nominated for an Oscar for a short feature.
But the movie had just the right amount of creepiness to it, because it kind of put you in that.
Yeah. There were moments like the weird. Yeah, if you watch The Fourth Kind, which I do recommend, it's an interesting film, you have to understand that in the first 2 minutes, Mila Jovovich comes out and says, "Hello, I'm Mila Jovovich. I will be playing this person in this film," and they will never mention that she talked to the camera ever again. You just have to accept that and then move on, and then there are some good moments. I mean, I personally prefer, like, science fiction is one of the few elements of horror that I think is still within the certain realms of plausibility.
Oh, one of my favorite horror movies is Event Horizon, which was sci-fi mixed with horror.
I had watched that. That is a great flick,
isn't it?
That is a great movie.
You know what I liked about that one? That one reminded, because it came out shortly after In the Mouth of Madness.
Yes.
And I was just like,
that
movie's
awesome.
Yes.
I'm like, In the Mouth of Madness in space.
Yes.
This is what this is.
Exactly.
And it's even got Sam Neill still. And Lawrence Fishburne. How could I not like this movie?
It's tricky when you're just talking horror, because nowadays especially, there's so many subgenres. Like, technically, Shaun of the Dead could qualify as horror, but are there
it's
any
a
moments
comedy sort of thing.
That really make it? It's a what they call it, a zomcom.
Zomcom.
You know. And there's a lot of elements. Slither kind of qualifies in that sort of thing.
Oh
too.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It had a lot of humor to it as well. And then you've got ones that nowadays you'd lean more towards sci-fi. Like, I mean, well, for example, would you put Prometheus in the same category as Alien? Even though they're technically the same universe, one is not a horror movie.
Yeah, one is an incompetently made
The
prequel.
Only horror of that is that it got made.
I convinced myself I'd like that one. But speaking, I don't know. It was in the theater, and I was like, I just paid for IMAX.
You know
I got to
convince
myself.
It was
my
the alien sound effect they used in the trailer. That's what it was.
The giant guy at the beginning throwing his goo in.
I could do a whole episode just on how poorly done that movie was.
But speaking of aliens, though, I do want to say, and Jeff, going back to your point about how sound is important, mm-hmm. and I think one of the films, that is an essential horror movie, and B, demonstrates the difference between comics and movies, is John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yes.
One of my
yes.
favorite horror movies, like, of
original
all time.
Remake.
Original. What am I, a monster?
Okay, just making sure. I am just making sure.
I paid to see the remake, the prequel in the theaters, and
oh
I was just
my
like,
God,
oh, come
why?
On. Yeah. But the original, first of all, has one of the greatest scores ever, done by the guy who did Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Amazing minimal score, like tense. Nominated for a Raspberry in 1982. People thought it was terrible. They were wrong. But they made...
They often are.
If you know on... if you go to like thatguywiththeglasses.com, they have a comic reviewer there called Linkara. He's done He's done a couple really interesting comic reviews of the thing, of comics based off of the thing. And they are all garbage. Because they don't... They can't capture that same atmosphere of what makes the thing such a great movie, well, of that cold isolation.
Is that the guy that does the long box of the day?
Yep. Yes, yep.
See, and that's the funny thing. That was something I actually wanted to talk about here, is some of the horror comics that start off as comics and end up in movie form have the same thing happen to them.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I'd say Hellboy turned out okay, and it was a comic that turned into a movie, and it was horror-based.
Yeah, but I'm
but with different degrees
like
of success.
28 Days Later just didn't have the same feel as the comic book. You know, I mean,
it was a comic book first.
Yeah.
Mind
30 Days of Night. You know,
yeah.
The Walking Dead television show. You know, it has been a great success, but the comic book just has something.
The comic book is so much better than the TV show.
But going in reverse as well, like you said, there's certain things that. You know, like trying to read an Alien comic,
which
doesn't have the same effect.
Yeah, when I saw Aliens when I was like 8 or 9, it was on like Fox's 3 p.m. Sunday movie, and it scared the hell out of me. And that was the first movie that really, really scared me. And then I started to read some of the Dark Horse Alien comics, and it got kind of goofy, where they would have like, you know, they'd have the there was the one where they had the like the Alien versus Predator, the second movie where they had the woman who joined the
Requiem.
Yeah, Requiem, mm-hmm. Where she sticks her head in an alien skull and uses it as a shield.
Oh no, that was the first.
Yeah, that was the first.
That was the first one. And like, oh come on, she should pull back a stump. A, but B, that same sort of that was originally from the comics, and it was pretty ridiculous then, and it was even more ridiculous once you saw it in an actual film.
Actually, it was a little less ridiculous in the comics because there was a lot more to that story that set it up.
Yeah,
than,
fair enough.
Than the
fair
movie
enough.
Did. So,
they're like, well, she's the survivor girl, so she's going to join the Predators.
Yeah, well, in the comic books, there was a lot more that she was an actual xenobiologist that went out.
Right.
Was basically researching the Predators, and she actually earned their trust to be accepted into their fold and become a hunter and everything. So,
and I think there's another, speaking of like the unknown, and one of my favorite Japanese horror movies, which can be either really long and morose or can actually keep that tension. Takashi Miike did Audition, which is one of the scariest movies because I think it taps into what you were saying, like the fear of the unknown, and that idea that the whole story of Audition is a producer in the Japanese film industry wants to find a wife, so he pretends to be doing a casting call for women for a role when he just wants to find a wife. And he ends up casting, he becomes obsessed with this one woman, and the more he learns about his backstory, the more he sort of starts to mentally fall apart as well, which is a really,
that's
really
kind of creepy.
It's a great movie. Totally worth it. A lot of Miike's stuff is really over the top gore, to the point of just being like ridiculous and okay, I get it, blood. Mm-hmm. But that one, Audition, is a really, really great movie.
Now, speaking of over the top gore and everything, do you guys think that that's something that's necessary to make a good horror movie?
No,
do you
not think, at all.
It, you know, if gore is used in the right context, like, for example, the zombie genre, if it's used properly, like Dawn of the Dead 1977, when the bikers start getting tore apart,
yeah,
that's an effective use. Stuff with, I'm trying to think of other horror movies that use gore effectively. The Walking Dead television show uses it effectively. But yeah, I'm kind of with you, Jeff. And like, it's not necessary if used properly. But
it's not just not necessary. And I'm not saying gore should be not used at all. I'm not saying that. But hands down, nothing on the screen can compete
with your mind,
your own imagination. What happens off screen is going to be infinitely worse than what you actually see.
Well,
at the same time,
but only
gonna,
if it's got the proper setup.
And you're not going to want an entire movie of everything happening off screen either.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, too much gore. Like, I can't stand the recent parade of, you know, Final Destinations and Saw and Hostel and everything. And granted, yes, Saw had a...
The cool, first two were good.
Everything it had a cool story going along with it, but it's like, it that just became this whole genre of...
Shock
horror, and it's just...
I think for me, the best balance of gore with that unknown, before it sort of fell apart, was the recent Joker arc in the Batman comics, mm-hmm. Death of the Family.
Yeah.
There was a great scene where the Joker, who at this point in the New 52 has had his face removed and is wearing it like a mask because comics, and he had kidnapped every one of the extended Bat family in each of their individual books,
yeah.
and had them all tied up with like bandages around their faces, and had implied that he was serving them under these sterling silver dishes. Like, the implication was he had cut off all their faces.
Mm-hmm.
Before they showed that was like a really great, like,
oh, that was,
tense moment. You read that.
It was horrific.
And yeah. it was, but because of what the potential was. And the implied, the joke to the whole thing was that he didn't do anything. And
he numbed
their faces, and they felt like it, again, there's an argument that was the whole point of what happened, that you were playing with expectations, et cetera, et cetera. But nothing could have justified, like, nothing, everything would have been a letdown after that.
Yeah.
It was such a perfect setup, mm-hmm. where everyone was around the dinner table with the bandages and the sterling silver. Yeah. And you're like, this is genuinely horrifying, and this is a valid use of gore. And then it just sort of, it fizzled out. But that moment is outstanding.
And you know, and this brings us to one of the things that Hollywood is completely guilty of right now, is they're making remakes of these horror movies and just increasing shock value on it. And that's all they're doing. Like, the remake mm-hmm. of the Friday the 13th, the remake of...
The Halloween remakes?
The Halloween remakes.
I could talk endlessly about every horror remake. However,
hey, man,
I will
Rob
say,
Zombie's wife needs work.
You know, yeah, she really does. She was really good in the first one.
I will say one thing. This past week, I did go and see Carrie, the remake, to the remake of the original, and it was solid.
It's competent. I'll say that. But
I saw it also.
Julianne Moore did a fantastic job.
Oh, my gosh. She was fantastic, yes.
Playing Carrie's mother and Hit Girl.
Chloe Grace Moretz. Hottie, whatever her name is.
You might want to save that kind of comment for when she's actually legal.
It doesn't matter. She will be someday.
Oh, wow. This took a turn.
Yeah.
Speaking of
anyway,
horror.
But no, but you're right, though. It's competent. I will say that. But it brings nothing new to the table other than the pregnancy angle.
Yeah.
But there's one point in that movie that made me bust a gut laughing. When Carrie kills the bitchy chick who hates her and Discount John Travolta, she turns in the Magneto.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, and that's something that pissed me off about this remake.
What, you didn't have a problem with her welding a lock shut?
Oh, yeah. Her sudden heat vision. But yeah.
She's Magneto and Cyclops?
She became... She could have auditioned for the X-Men about 30 minutes into this movie because she had such control over her powers.
Sounds terrible. The whole concept behind Carrie is she's a girl that gets telekinesis.
Yeah.
How did she know that the girl was pregnant? The girl was pregnant with a female?
Because I guess...
How does telekinesis give you clairvoyancy?
Well, she also had pyrokinesis too, right? So I guess it's supposed to be her deeper connection to accessing whatever ability she has.
I love how this was a really solid movie. Now let's all pick it apart.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's what we do.
Yeah, welcome to fanboyism.
But one thing that I did like about it is that it was competent. It updated it with cyberbullying. I thought that was really clever.
I completely agree. I thought that was good. Go ahead.
Another thing... The thing I liked about this one is this Carrie seemed more vengeful. This one had a directive.
Mm.
It was, whereas Sissy Spacek's Carrie was more reactive. When she freaked out in the gym, it was not directed at all. When Chloe freaks out in the gym, dead.
Not just that.
Or spared.
Yeah, it's not just that, but if you watch that scene after she goes nuts and starts killing people, as opposed to Sissy Spacek's portrayal of the role, Chloe almost looks like she's enjoying it.
Oh, yeah. And, like, it's that sadistic joy.
My friend who I saw it with, he was telling me that he didn't like it, and he felt there was a real missed opportunity here to tie this into, like, bullying. Clearly that opportunity wasn't missed. Tying it into bullying and, like, school shootings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They really kind of didn't touch on that at all.
I could see it as you push the kid too far, you get exactly what's coming to you.
But that almost glorifies a school shooting, then.
Yeah, true. Well, if there's less
only
your
mom's Julianne Moore.
I will say this. Will Wheaton said it best. Don't be a dick. But yeah, it's one of the better remakes, and one horror remake that actually predates it as one of the best remakes and updates. 1986's The Blob. Superior to the original in every way. Plus Shawnee Smith and a kid dissolving into a skeleton.
Which is always going to be classic, let's be honest. Like, skeletons rule.
Horror remakes are really hard to do. Like, some of them are completely unnecessary. Carrie, I would venture it was unnecessary, but it didn't disrespect the source material. And I think that's what makes it competent.
I think one of my main issues with the movie, and like I said, I did enjoy it too. But one of my main issues was that it seemed like they were having trouble trying to decide if they wanted to keep it like the original or they wanted to try to tread new ground. And it was kind of lost in between the two. It's like they didn't go completely one direction or the other.
Mm-hmm. Although I will say this version's Tommy Ross was a lot more likable.
Yeah.
Speaking of remakes, there's one comic remake I wanted to mention. Which was John Ostrander in the mid-90s, looking at my giant pile of wizards here. I can't help but be transported back into the halcyon days of yore. John Ostrander did a really great run of The Spectre, which DC, of course, hasn't collected into trades. But it is all about John Ostrander, for people who don't know, his father was, I believe, a Protestant minister or something. So he had a really strong connection to religion. And then John Ostrander was, I believe, an atheist, and he had that conflict. And he used a lot of, he used the Spectre, and this is like from 94, so with like one to, I think it was issue 70 or something. He used all these Spectre issues to address sort of religious, existential religious issues, looking at, you know, who is justified in doing what. And there are really great issues of basically the Spectre deciding, I'm going to get rid of all the evil on the Earth, and him going through every superhero in the Earth trying to discuss with him and be like, "What? Are you sure? Is this what?" He's like, "Yeah, pretty much. This is going to solve my problem." And it's that sort of amoral character that is another really good one. Peter David's Captain Marvel run in the early 2000s, which was competing with Marvel. If you remember Marvel back in the early 2000s, yeah. Terrible piece of crap comic. But his Captain Marvel was a really great character who was the same thing, became cosmically aware in the sense that, I think I talked about this before when this was back when Jim Starlin was advocating drug use, where he's like, oh, you took a lot of pills and became cosmically aware. That's great. Yeah, for the 70s. And the whole point is that Peter David wrote Captain Marvel as this guy who knew everything and knew what was going to happen and knew what he was doing. And it basically drove him insane and turned him into a mad god, which is another example of using that idea of like a character who is really smart and doing what he thinks is for the best, which connects to like Frankenstein and connects to all those other issues. And I think a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about, the really cool horror stuff, is the stuff that makes us think about our lives. Mm-hmm. To put a little bow on my rambling dissertation there.
I think that pretty much sums it up. In fact, we've actually gone over time for this episode, guys. So I guess we should begin to wrap it up. So I guess, question, go around the room. Favorite horror movie, least favorite horror movie?
Oh, for me, I would have to say my least favorite is Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Really, I love that one!
That movie just, I don't know. It
bothers you?
Well, no.
Just all the K's. Come on.
It was just so horrible. Anyway, my favorite horror movie is I love In the Mouth of Madness. It's one of my favorite
crazy horror movies. It's great. What about you, Jim?
I've got two that I want to say positive things about. One, I just watched this week. The guy who did Drive, Nicholas Winding Refn, I can never pronounce his name. His first big movie was called Fear X, starring John Turturro. It is a very limited release movie. It's hard to find, but it's a great movie about a man trying to deal with the death of his wife while also going kind of insane. And it's an unreliable narrator story, and it's a really amazing, especially if you like In the Mouth of Madness, I really recommend Fear X. And the second one is a Canadian movie, which goes back to looking at atmosphere. It's called Beyond the Black Rainbow. And if you have it, it's like cough syrup the movie. It's one of those movies that oozes out of the television and just draws you into the world, and everything starts moving slower and feeling. It's like a drug trip in movie form, and it draws you into this world. Mm-hmm. And it's all about basically a woman or a girl with unspecified powers tapping into the unknown, being kept in this 1980s laboratory, and it's everything from her perspective sort of the reasons that she's kept there. And it's a really, really great watch with an amazing soundtrack. Huh. Jeff, how about yourself?
Well, as for me, because I haven't necessarily watched a ton of horror, and I go for B movies, as terrible as are. Like, I was up at midnight a couple months back watching Sharknado on Space. You know, I'll look at a bad movie and I'll appreciate it for how bad it is. I have a DVD copy of Lake Placid. You know,
oh, nice. Bill Pullman.
Exactly. And Oliver Platt. He didn't eat meats because he just ate a cow, stupid. I'm not going to necessarily give a least favorite, because I'll appreciate the schlock for what it is. But
as long as the schlock is actually going into it knowing that it's schlock.
I nominate puked up John Voight from Anaconda.
Oh, bravo. Yes. With the wink.
With the wink.
Yes. But two horror movies that I've always loved, and it's a shame, actually, I don't even own one of these. I'll have to pick it up sometime. And it just shows of when I grew up, was Jaws, the first one.
Yes.
Although the second one, I still stand by being pretty good as well. And Ghostbusters.
Mike, Mike, what do you got?
For myself, for classic horror, Frankenstein. And I didn't realize how much I loved it until really last week. Just really love the atmosphere and the portrayals. Favorite modern one, Night of the Comet.
Ooh.
Really cool when you really get into it. Plus, Commander Chakotay running around Los Angeles is pretty awesome. Robert Beltran. Least favorite, I'll say the most disappointing, and that was Nightmare on Elm Street's remake.
Yes.
You don't make Freddy Krueger a sympathetic villain. I appreciate what you're trying to do, but no. And probably Halloween 2 by Rob Zombie.
Yo.
I've heard his second one was pretty bad.
It's brutally stupid. It insults your intelligence. So yes, guys, coming up on the show next week here on Beyond the Gauntlet, we're going to be looking at ABC's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which recently got picked up for a full order season. And there'll be a new episode on tomorrow. Or not tomorrow, on November 5th, rather. So that'll be next week's show. So we'll talk about the season thus far, and where the show could go, where it should go, and what it's doing right, what it's doing wrong. So, for Beyond the Gauntlet, I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd with...
Jamie, the last thing I want to find in my superhero trick-or-treat bag is a jar full of something that came out of MODOK McBurney.
And I'm Jeff. You're going to need a bigger boat to hand.
And Chris, there's another full moon out tonight.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.